This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Star Trek Discovery, Fear Itself by James Swallow. Based on Star Trek created by Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek Discovery created by Brian Fuller and Alex Kurtzman. Read by Robert Petkoff.
For Brian Fuller, with thanks for all the advice. Historian's Note. This story takes place in 2252. It is 4 years before a day in May 2256 when a fateful meeting between the USS Shenzhou and T'Kuvma's followers will spark a war with the Klingon Empire. Star Trek Discovery, Battle of the Binary Stars. Nothing routs us but the villainy of our fears. William Shakespeare. Cymbeline, Act 5, Scene 2. One. Out in the darkness, unseen and unheard, the danger was waiting for Saru. He crouched low to the floor, his long arms and legs folded up close to his slim torso. He kept his head bowed and his eyes closed, extending his senses into the room, seeking the presence of the threat. The aural channels of the Kelpian's lobeless ears and pits on the surface of his scalp channeled every last fraction of sound into his awareness. Electrosensitive nerve clusters beneath the skin of his face and along the backs of his thin fingers tasted the constant background hum of the vessel around him. He instinctively sifted the wash of sense noise for anything untoward and found nothing. Slowly, Saru opened his eyes. His vision instantly adjusted to the dimness of the unlit compartment. He unfolded to his full height, rising with his back to the corner of the room and the only doorway in or out in front of him. Shadowy shapes crowded the edges of his vision. His sleeping pallet, a desk and computer unit, a table upon which stood a careworn box made of carved wood, a three-dimensional chess set, and a data pad. The objects were benign, unthreatening, or at least that was what he was meant to think. He stood there for a full 2 minutes without expelling a breath. To an outside observer, he would have appeared totally inert, a strange statue in the still life of the cabin. Then he moved, in quick, economical motions. It was exactly 5 hoofsteps from the far corner of the room to the door, and Saru could cover it in an instant if he chose to. But today, he stepped evenly, carefully. It was the pace of one passive and harmless, one who did not wish to upset the equilibrium of whatever might be waiting in the gloom. He was taking his third step when he noticed a pair of identical cups sitting on the disposal tray of the cabin's food slot. There was no need for there to be two. Saru had no company in these quarters. As a Starfleet lieutenant, his rank was of sufficient level and the USS Shenzhou was a ship of enough tonnage to afford him the advantage of privacy in his billet. And he was too fastidious to needlessly fabricate a second drinking container when one already existed. The metallic shape of the cup rippled with an oily light, and he turned toward it, instinctively drawn by motion where none should have followed. The cup changed. The cylindrical shape transformed into something between a gel and a powder, dropping into a pool of itself. It rebounded into a spiny form that resembled a cluster of skittering crustacean legs, a knot of shiny limbs that had no hub to them. The creature exploded into motion, its greasy sensor palps detecting the change in air density as Saru moved past it. The tips of its legs hardened into a density near that of tempered steel. Once it found a victim, the creature would seek the softest tissues through which to force its limbs, and after dermal penetration had occurred, it would eat. This was a process in three stages. Paralysis of the target life form caused by an extruded neurotoxin, then systematic liquefaction of all nerve tissue, as agonizing as it was horrific, and finally, consumption of internal organs from within. The victim would mercifully be dead by the time the third stage occurred. If the meal was of sufficient richness, the engorged attacker would enter a budding cycle and reproduce. One well-fed creature could spawn many times, given adequate sustenance. Saru's tall corpse would provide more than enough for a dozen generations. He froze as it landed on his shoulder, and the cluster of legs halted, the needle tips hesitating. It moved around the nape of his neck, across the back of his head, and then down his arm, palps twitching at the air. Its behavior suggested it was confused. The movement it had detected now ceased. In the creature's primitive predatory brain, it could not understand how a prey thing of such mass could be in motion one instant and still in the next. It was used to the thrashing and panicked frenzy of a target, the confirmation that it had found its next meal. Saru remained immobile as the thing picked its way down the length of his dark blue uniform, plucking at the cloth. Presently it became disinterested and dropped off, clattering to the deck. He watched it wander across the floor before finally reconfiguring itself. The simple little polymorph reverted back to the last form it had adopted, once again becoming a passable copy of the ceramic cup. Sitting on the deck in front of the door, it looked odd and out of place. Saru took a breath and surged forward, bringing one heavy hoofed boot to stamp on the creature before it could revert. It glittered as it died, not through organic means, but in transformation as it became a flash of fading holographic pixels.
"Simulation concluded," said a feminine voice from a computer panel on the far wall. "Do you wish to reset?"
"What was that?" Saru said to the air, refreshed with the rush of adrenaline tingling through his body.
"The holoprojection was a mature example of the species Salazinus metamorphii, colloquial name Salazar's Fane, a type 2 hazardous mimetic lifeform native to a class Y world in the Lembata cluster. Do you wish to reset?"
Again, he ignored the question and posed one of his own.
"That felt slow to me. Was I slow? Would it have killed me in reality?" "Negative. Your reaction time was sufficient to avoid a fatality. However, you were 1.3 milliseconds slower than your previous recorded instance."
"Ah, yes, of course." Saru glanced up at the holographic projector module he had mounted on the ceiling of his quarters. That previous time, the simulation program had randomly generated a Denebian slime devil lurking in the waste disposal slot, and the thing had almost scored a bite that, if it had been real, would have taken off two of his fingers at the second joint.
"Reason?" he demanded. "Authorization required to access medical scans in order to generate conjecture," said the computer.
"Yes, yes," he said tersely, gesturing at the air. "Authorization Kappa Saru 7.
"Working."
He glanced out of the cabin's port, observing an unmoving field of alien stars framed against a fathomless reach of night. Off the Shenzhou's port bow, Saru's keen eyesight picked out a smooth-sided slab of gray metal, its surface marred by heavy carbon scoring. He studied it, then looked away. By rights, Saru should have already been on his way to his duty station, but this was something he didn't want to put off. He'd been feeling sluggish and ill at ease for a few days, and if something was slowing him down, it was important he knew now, before anyone else did.
"Analysis complete," announced the computer. "Blood sugar levels are below recommended margins."
Saru blew out a breath. "Ah." Twice in the last 3 days he had missed a meal in the mess hall and filled the gap with a ration bar. That, combined with the stress of his current assignment, explained it.
I cannot afford to be slow, he said to the air. The slow and the weak are as good as dead.
Please restate command.
Suspend program, Saru snapped irritably, then added, for now. The whole purpose of the hologram predators and the randomizing software that generated them was to keep him sharp, he reminded himself. Left to exist on only the baseline level of response stimuli that his crewmates took for granted, Saru found himself climbing the walls, as Ensign Yanuzi had once colorfully described it. The simulation helped to keep Saru focused, and more importantly, it was a constant reminder of the singular truth that he believed above all others. The universe was an inherently dangerous place, which would kill the unwary and the unprepared in a heartbeat. Brushing lint off the silver tabs on the flanks of his uniform, Saru drew himself up and picked up the data pad from the table before stepping quickly out into the corridor beyond, and directly into the path of Chief Petty Officer Zuzub. The Catharian security guard made a click-clacking noise with his wide mandibles and stepped back, apologetically raising his arms.
Pardon, pardon, Lieutenant, murmured the insectoid's shoulder-mounted vocoder unit. Bridge has us on a drill, sir, in a hurry.
Hmm, Saru managed, pushing away the flash of instant terror that had briefly come over him at the sight of a massive predatory arthropod looming in the corridor.
Carry on.
Zuzub's large head bobbed, and he went on his way. The Catharian was actually a friendly sort, but his species had a fearsome aspect that belied their gentler nature. Saru considered this as he set off in the other direction. He had met many sentients since joining Starfleet and had visited several alien worlds. On an intellectual level, he understood that the outward appearance of most beings bore no connection to their inner natures. But it was hard to get past a lifetime of instinctive, ingrained reactions and a physiology like his, one attuned toward the triggering of a fight-or-flight reflex at the slightest impetus. Saru continued on, having decided to postpone reporting to the secondary systems laboratory on Deck 3 in favor of attending to a baser need, a decent breakfast. He could use the time to go over his notes on the datapad and prepare for the day's work. Moving along the corridor in loping, long steps, he nodded in passing as two human ensigns from the astrogeology department crossed his path. Humans always seemed so relaxed to Saru. Dangerously so, in fact. He wondered if they, like him, felt the pull of their primitive natures dragging against their evolved selves. Their open, smooth faces bereft of attractive striation, and the blank regularity of their sensory aura fields made it hard for Saru to parse the more subtle emotional states of their species. It required careful observation and evaluation on his part, and that could be tiring. Not for the first time, he wondered what it would be like going through life without being able to hear the ghost hum of electromagnetic energy emitted by everything around him. It would be no different from living without a sense of taste or smell. For Saru, the Shenzhou purred to itself as the starship's systems operated in synchrony, the engines for now on standby as the vessel drifted at station keeping. Had they been moving at impulse power, he would have known it the moment he stepped out of his cabin. There was a distinct resonance of the EM field that he felt somewhere near the crown of his scalp when they cruised at sublight, and a sharper timbre created by the bleed effect of warp travel that gathered at the base of his neck. After years in Starfleet, the Kelpian had become habituated to the effects, but there were still times, usually when he was fatigued, when they made it hard for him to concentrate. The captain had graciously allowed Saru to have a layer of baffle plating fitted around the walls of his quarters to aid his sleep, a fact that he was forever grateful for. He sensed another human approaching just before Shenzhou's chief engineer, deep in thought, came around a corner in the corridor and strode briskly past him. Lieutenant Commander Saladin Johar took a couple of steps and then executed a swift about-face to stare up at Saru.
Science officer? He began, as if framing a question.
Yes, sir.
Saru rocked to a halt, balancing on the tips of his hooves.
I was on my way down to the bridge. Maybe you can save me the turbolift ride.
Most humans were shorter than the gangly Kelpian, and Saru found that many of them exhibited an unconscious defensiveness when forced to look up at someone, just as Johar did now. He resisted the urge to hunch forward as the chief engineer went on.
My team is ready to deploy the replacement buoy as soon as you give us the green light. I'm wondering why you are making us wait.
There are questions that still need to be answered, said Saru, his hands finding each other around the data pad. Lieutenant Burnham and I are in the process of a full investigation of the damaged unit. It would be unwise to launch a replacement until we are certain what caused the previous buoy to malfunction.
That's what you told me in the last staff meeting, 20 hours ago.
Johar eyed him, his tawny face creasing in a frown. The engineer had been pulling double duty over the last week, filling in for Lieutenant Commander Itzel Garcia while the Shenzhou's second officer was away on Pacifica, but that didn't mean he was about to let anything slip by on his watch. Saru experimented with a shrug. My explanation remains the same, sir. The damage was extensive. The cause is unclear. It's taking us a while to analyze. He didn't add that his disagreements with Michael Burnham over exactly how to handle the analysis had put a noticeable strain on the process. To say that Saru and the human woman did not see eye to eye was something of an understatement. Burnham's tendency to become hyper-focused on certain details frequently clashed with Saru's innate desire to seek a more reductionist solution to problems, a disposition that stemmed from her education among Vulcans, he imagined, and while he was firmly a by-the-book analyst, her disinclination to consider other approaches was at times stifling. Johar's expression didn't change. The chief engineer wasn't happy with the answer.
Speed things along, Lieutenant, he said, walking away. Otherwise cobwebs will start forming on the warp nacelles.
Saru nodded, not quite following the idiom, and continued on toward the mess hall as the problem at hand pushed its way to the front of his thoughts. The remote monitoring buoy the Shenzhou had located 2 days earlier was one of a wide network of autonomous, self-sufficient devices seeded throughout this sector of space by Starfleet Command. Dozens of identical units, cylindrical modules the size of photon torpedoes, drifted out here on the frontier of the United Federation of Planets. Each contained a compact fusion reactor, an ion drive, a suite of high-acuity sensors, and a long-range subspace transceiver array slaved to an expert computer system. Under ideal conditions, the buoys could operate for up to 20 standard years before requiring replacement. They would listen for energy patterns or communications from out beyond the edge of Federation space. Endlessly watchful, ready to sound a warning if a threat made its presence known, they were Starfleet's silent sentinels. And they were stationed here with good cause. A few light-years distant lay the borders of another interstellar power, the maddeningly vague edges of the Tholian Assembly. Saru recalled what he had learned about the antagonistic crystalline species during his years at Starfleet Academy. They had an unpredictable, bellicose nature and a tendency toward punctuality and hostile actions. The Kelpian had never seen one of their dart-shaped spinner ships outside of blurry data tape images, and he had no desire to do so. Everyone on board the Shenzhou knew that the Tholians would be out there somewhere, watching the Starfleet ship's every move from the extreme edge of sensor range. Saru imagined them like the Ba'ul, the apex predators from his homeworld, which would lie in wait until they struck out at their prey. The logical assumption, at least by Saru's lights, was that the monitor buoy had fallen victim to Tholian aggression, but if that were proven true, it would invite a whole new raft of problems for the Shenzhou and Starfleet to deal with. Burnham had raised an eyebrow at Saru's leap of reasoning, noting that proximity to the Assembly didn't automatically make the Tholians the culprits. Quite rightly, she pointed out that there were other sentient species in the non-aligned border space between the two larger states, as well as stellar phenomena and other possible causes for the damage that the unit had suffered. Saru knew she was correct, but the Kelpian had lived this long only because of his species' unerring sense for the dangerous, and right now that pragmatic streak was telling him to prepare for the worst. The junior science officer was thinking of how he would explain that to Burnham when he stepped through the doors into the mess hall and found the dark-skinned human female seated at a table in front of him. She was young and intense. Burnham's gaze had a searching quality to it, and Saru always felt like she was on the verge of action, even as her more moderated manner reeled her back in. She paused with her spoon in the bowl of food in front of her and saw the data pad in his hand. Burnham nodded at her own pad, propped up on the table. Like Saru's, it showed blocks of dense text from the preliminary close-range analysis of the buoy. "Lieutenant, it appears we had the same idea this morning."
"Lieutenant?" he repeated.
"It would seem so." Resigned to the way this would now play out, Saru got himself some muesli and yogurt from the food synthesizer, seasoned it with a generous amount of Aldebaran paprika, then took the seat across the table from Burnham. She didn't give him time to start eating.
"I've reviewed the sensor readings, again. A physical teardown of the damaged unit in the lab is the next logical step. Remote analysis simply isn't giving us the answers we need."
Saru doggedly chewed a large spoonful before replying.
"Captain Georgiou's orders were clear. Proceed with caution. If we bring the buoy on board before we know for certain that it does not pose a risk to the ship, we will be negligent in our duties."
"It's inert," insisted Burnham. "I am sure of that."
"I know you are sure," he countered.
"There comes a point where a degree of risk has to be accepted," she went on. "This ship wouldn't be out here if that wasn't true. Starfleet wouldn't exist. You would still be living on Kaminar."
"It could be booby-trapped," said Saru, cutting off her train of thought. "The Tholians have been known to use such tactics."
"There's no proof they're responsible."
The ghost of a smile played over her lips.
"But that is a fair point."
"All right. If you won't let me bring it to us, we'll go to it."
"What?" Saru blinked.
"You and I can go out in thruster suits. With the work we need to do, I don't estimate the EVA operation lasting more than, say, 10 or 12 hours.
Saru's skin prickled. The notion of floating around in deep space with only a few layers of flex mesh and a bubble helmet between him and an instant freeze-boiling death did not appeal to the Kelpian.
"It has been a while since my last zero-G refresher course," he admitted.
"Really?" Burnham arched her eyebrow in a very Vulcan fashion.
"Perhaps you'd like to reconsider my previous suggestion."
Her tone made him bristle, and irritation flared in Saru's eyes. His jaw dropped open slightly in an instinctive reaction, exposing the sensing surface in the roof of his mouth. Back on Kaminar, the action would allow his species to taste the air and pick up traces of predators, but here and now it was a signifier of his annoyance at Burnham's attempt to take charge of their shared assignment. It would have been easy to give in to complete dislike of the human if it wasn't for the fact that she was good at what she did. Saru couldn't deny that she had a sharp, incisive mind, and that only made things worse. It was no secret aboard the Shenzhou that Lieutenant Michael Burnham was a rising star, charting an ascent through the ranks that was positively meteoric. Saru had heard other officers talking about her as the front-runner for the post of ship's exec in a few years when the time came for the current first officer, Commander Chethalo, to go on to a ship of his own. That sat poorly with the Kelpian. Saru's own career was tracing a much flatter trajectory, a slow and steady path he had built through hard work and careful deliberation. He was a scientist. That was his first and truest impulse, but the role of XO and the road that led to command of a starship beckoned to Saru in a way that nothing in his life ever had. He didn't believe in concepts like destiny, but after leaving his homeworld for Starfleet Academy,
Saru believed that there was a true vocation he was best suited for. Captain of a starship, exploring the unknown, keeping the Federation safe. That was a future he dared to aspire to. But Burnham would get there first. He could sense the inevitability of it. She would eclipse him and race ahead, and on some level the human knew so. In his more pessimistic moments, Saru wondered if Burnham saw him as an obstacle in her path toward the center seat. He couldn't read her, and anything Saru could not read, he automatically considered to be a danger. Before he could stop himself, he was returning to the pattern of argumentative discourse that seemed to color every conversation between the two lieutenants. "The act of beaming the unit aboard could trigger a concealed weapon," he said quickly. "A protective force field would need to be set up around the lab to contain any possible discharge." Burnham tapped her pad. "I programmed a suitable containment field macro earlier this morning." "Of course you did," he muttered. "I find it difficult to understand why someone raised in the Vulcan doctrines fails to grasp the logic of being careful." Her eyes narrowed. "Just as I fail to understand how a being who grew up around lethal predators can't make a value judgment between a real danger and an illusory one. Only so much can be achieved by watching from the sidelines, Saru." He drew back and fixed her with an arch look. "I recall a human aphorism about fools rushing in." Burnham's lip curled. "We've been at this for days. There's no rushing of any kind going on." She let out a breath. "Which is why I chose to proceed with the transport before I started my breakfast." "What?" Saru shot to his feet and took a step toward the ports along the length of the mess hall. He immediately looked out toward the bow where he had seen the buoy adrift from his cabin. The object was no longer visible. Burnham got up and walked over. "We're all still here. So I guess that means the buoy wasn't booby-trapped after all." "You had no right to proceed without me." Saru's words were tight with annoyance, and he glared out at the stars. "We may share the same rank, but I have served longer. I have seniority." She stood beside him, looking at the void. "This isn't about that. I'm not trying to undermine you, I'm trying to complete our assignment." "By ignoring regulations?" "By interpreting them," Burnham shot back, "to best effect." "Then what was the point of that comment about the EVA? She shrugged. "I was interested to see how you would reply." Saru turned to face her, raising a finger, belatedly becoming aware that someone was standing behind the two of them. "Your assignment is to analyze the buoy, not my response to—" He trailed off as he realized that the new arrival was Shenzhou's commanding officer, Captain Philippa Georgiou. Burnham, too, reacted with surprise at the other woman's appearance. The captain had an unerring ability to approach out of nowhere that even Saru's acute senses sometimes missed, and a mentor's seemingly bottomless patience for the quirks of her crew. A wry smile played on Georgiou's face as she sipped at a mug of tea. "Oh, Mr. Saru," she began, "don't stop on my account. It's fascinating to watch my officers bickering in their natural habitat." "It isn't—" Saru stiffened in embarrassment. "We were not—" To her credit, Burnham had the honesty to look as contrite as Saru felt. "We weren't bickering, Captain. It was more of a spirited—" "Spirited discussion," Saru added, "between two differing scientific methods," concluded Burnham, as the pair of them patched together a shared explanation. "Was it?" Georgiou said mildly, and with those words Saru briefly felt like an errant child called to account by an elder. At his side, Burnham stood as stiffly as he did. "While I approve of competing schools of thought aboard my ship, I do draw the line at outright disagreement." The captain took another sip and eyed them both. "You are two of my best officers. Your skills are meant to complement each other, not create friction." Another commander might have made those words an admonishment, but not Philippa Georgiou. She made it sound like a challenge, like a request. Her smile deepened. Well, not too much. Lieutenant Saru and I will have an updated report by the end of the shift, said Burnham. I'll inform the chief engineer he can deploy the replacement buoy. She gave Saru a questioning look that asked, Do you agree? Of course. Saru was going to add more, but then a flicker of faint light at the corner of his vision drew the Kelpian's attention back to the mess hall's windows. For a brief instant, out in the darkness, a needle-sharp glint of hard white color flashed and then faded.
Saru, what is it?
Burnham looked in the same direction, her brow creasing in concern.
Did you see that?
It was possible that Burnham and the captain had not, as human optical ranges did not venture as far into the ultraviolet as that of Kelpians.
A flash of light, like a distant supernova.
Saru paused. Had he been mistaken? He was still wondering when the strident tones of a bosun's whistle sounded as the Shenzhou's intraship activated and the stern, uncompromising voice of the first officer issued out of the air.
Captain and senior officers, report to the bridge immediately.
A chill crawled up the base of Saru's spine as he stared out in the direction of the flicker, and the brief instance of curiosity he felt began to shade toward fear. Burnham followed her captain onto the Shenzhou's bridge, with Saru loping along a pace behind. In the middle of the command deck, the captain's chair swiveled toward them, and Commander Chithelo stepped smartly out of it, drawing up to full attention.
"Captain on the bridge," he snapped briskly, and the Andorian's antennae arched.
Chithelo had an open face at odds with his rigid manner. His adherence to military protocol sometimes seemed overly ceremonial to Burnham, but the first officer's razor-like efficiency was without question, as was his ability to marshal the bridge crew in a time of crisis. Surveying the other stations, Burnham saw that every duty officer was hard at work. She moved to the science console, with Saru still shadowing her, and cast a glance toward Ensign Troke at secondary scanner control. The pale blue Tulian shot her a wary look as he tapped the wireless data implant on his neck. Something is up. Captain Georgiou took her seat and turned back to the main viewer, studying the display projected on the inner surface of the bowl-like observation dome that formed the lowest deck of the Shenzhou's space frame. Chithelo already had a tactical plot laid across the starscape, the few scattered suns and dust clouds in the nearby region highlighted in glowing blue and green.
Report, ordered the captain.
As always, the first officer wasted no time with preamble.
Anomalous energy discharge at extreme range. Subspace frequencies diffuse at this distance, but enough to trip our sensors.
As Chithelo spoke, Burnham brought up the pattern of the energy effect that Troke had fed to the console and scrutinized it. Saru peered over her shoulder to follow the analysis.
Phase wave pulse, he offered,
his skull-like aspect creasing in thought.
Artificial?
She nodded, pointing at the smooth peaks and troughs of the wave pattern.
Agreed. The high-order regularity would make that likely. A natural phenomenon would be more random.
Engineer Johar was calling down almost the instant it reached us, continued the first officer. Said the discharge was registering on his board in engineering.
From this far away?
Georgiou pivoted to look in Burnham and Saru's direction.
Lieutenants, what's your take on this?
Burnham inclined her head, letting Saru take the lead. He cleared his throat.
The flash of light I saw from the mess hall appears to be the visual component of a subspace energy shock.
I believe we are looking at a localized, high-intensity quantum effect generated by an artificial source.
It's a nadion pulse, added Burnham.
Captain, nadion particles are generated by directed energy weapons,
Cameron Gant, Shenzhou's senior tactical officer, spoke up.
The Romulans use that technology.
Noted, but we are a long way from the Star Empire.
said Giorgio, quashing that line of speculation before it could begin. What else could be responsible? A polaric ion power matrix, offered Saru. Certain varieties of contrafield warp drives use nadion injection primers. Burnham was listening with half an ear as she worked the console in front of her, assembling a virtual model of what the epicenter of the pulse would look like, based on the readings, the distance, and the particle decay rate. What formed on the holographic screen in front of her was alarming. Captain, the initial source of the pulse was very strong. The fact that the UV radiation flare was visible to Saru means that this was a catastrophic release. I think we may have just witnessed the destruction of a starship. Not the destruction, Saru corrected. He leaned in to tap out a command string on the panel, and a blurry quadrant of the viewer shimmered as it refocused. If that were so, we would be picking up a broad field of irradiated wreckage. Confirming, said Troke, staring into the middle distance as his data implant beamed new readings directly into his cerebral cortex. I have a high probability detection of two discrete objects at the origin point of the pulse. Ships. The captain shot a look toward Ensign Fan at the communication station. Mary, are you receiving any signals from those vessels? Fan held a wireless transceiver to her ear and gave a slow shake of the head. Nothing, Captain. Her cat-like expression tightened in concentration. But local subspace is so heavy with static from the pulse, they could be broadcasting Denobulan opera at full blast, and we wouldn't hear it. Captain? The young officer at the rear of the bridge, where Shenzhou's engineering monitor station was located, raised his voice. I want to add, nadion pulse? Not good. Agreed, Ensign Wheaton, said Giorgio. Go on. Lieutenant Saru is right about some warp matrix designs using that tech, but it's flaky as hell. Wheaton made a complex shape in the air in front of him, trying to illustrate a point of quantum physics with just his fingers. A particle release of this magnitude is enough to blow any passing ship out of warp. If we hadn't been at station keeping, it would have thrown us out of warp, and anyone right in the middle of it would be staring down the barrel of a core breach. Burnham watched the shift in the captain's expression, and she knew where Giorgio's thoughts were going. And so did Commander Chithalo, the Andorian's antennae drooping slightly as he gave a grave shake of the head.
Before you say it, warned the first officer, take another look at the TAC map. Detmer, zoom out on that.
The woman at the helm tapped a control, and the tactical graphic dropped back to a larger scale, showing a wide swath of the border space.
I don't have to tell you we're on the edge of a danger zone here.
The location of the pulse's epicenter glowed in the middle of two overlapping patches of color.
The phenomenon is located inside an area declared as a buffer region by both the Tholians and a non-aligned post-contact race called the Pelear. By any interpretation, it's outside of our jurisdiction.
But it's not outside our responsibility, Number One. Giorgio sat back in her chair, and her eyes briefly met Burnham's. Lieutenant, any indications that the pulse may reoccur and damage Shenzhou? Unknown, Burnham replied. She hated not having more information to give, but the scans were vague and conflicted. If we approach, we will be going in blind, insisted Saru, and he felt Burnham tense by his side. She was thinking the same thing. Noted. Giorgio turned back to face the main viewer. Ensign Detmer, plot an intercept course. Note in the ship's log we are departing our station and transiting from Federation space. Captain! Saru blurted out the word, his hand flicking up to the back of his head as a set of fine feelers emerged out of the skin there. Burnham had seen this reaction from the Kelpian before, the appearance of his threat ganglia, a pure reflexive response that occurred whenever Saru's species sensed the presence of an imminent threat. The Tholians! They will consider any transgression into their space as an invasion. I am well aware, said Giorgio. But we've seen no sign of them in all the time we've been here, Mr. Saru. And technically, the buffer zone isn't actually theirs. I'm not going to let the possibility of their displeasure prevent us from rendering assistance to beings in grave danger. We're going.
Course laid in, reported Detmer. Engage engines, ordered the captain.
Out beyond the viewer, the static pattern of stars leaped closer, transforming into warped streaks of light as the Shenzhou plunged through the barriers of relativistic motion. Saru made a quiet negative noise as he massaged the back of his scalp, unconsciously retreating a step from the science console.
I hope we don't regret this, he muttered.
Commander Chithalo crossed to the science console and made a show of looking at the display in front of Burnham.
I need you watching the sensors like a Tarkalian hawk, Lieutenant. The first inkling you have that the pulse might reoccur, I want to know about it.
Aye, sir. She gave a nod as the Andorian turned to Saru and put a hand on his shoulder. The Shenzhou's executive officer was the only one on the ship close to Saru's over 2 meter height, and he gave the Kelpian a hard look.
Caution is useful, noted the commander. But there's such a thing as worrying too much. Don't expend your energy dealing with problems we don't have yet.
I understand, sir, Saru replied, glancing at Burnham. But several ships have been lost without a trace in this sector over the years. Only a few weeks ago, a J-class transport belonging to the Evans Charter went missing.
Fret not, Mr. Saru, said the captain, speaking loudly enough for the whole bridge to hear her. I'm not about to let the Shenzhou, or those ships out there, become another statistic.
Saru's reply was glum. Unfortunately, Captain, my species is genetically predisposed toward fretting. 2. The warp jump went from a smooth transit via non-Einsteinian space to a juddering, shaking race against invisible lines of spatial scission. Shenzhou was an old ship, a Walker class in the light cruiser range, and she had weathered more than her fair share of hard journeys since the day she came off the orbital slips. Still, the hull creaked alarmingly as feedback from the structural integrity fields resonated back down her forward saucer section and along the pylons of her underslung warp nacelles. The concentrated particles of the fading Nadion pulse had the effect of destabilizing any conventional starship's warp matrix, to the point that passing through a dense pocket of them would make the faster-than-light bubble evaporate and send any vessel that fell victim crashing back toward sublight velocity. A ship without adequate protection would crumple instantly from the sheer force of unplanned deceleration. But Shenzhou was an old warhorse, and she was tough. It would take much more than this to bring her down. Space thickened around the starship as it closed in on the epicenter of the effect, and the vessel described a looping spiral to cross the distance. A head-on approach would have been like steering through mud. This way, Shenzhou skated across the top of the decaying Nadion field and kept up her momentum. Ahead of the Starfleet vessel, two alien craft drifted in a flickering haze of ice-blue Cherenkov radiation. The first was just over twice the size of a shuttlecraft, its core fuselage resembling a bulbous projectile with a pair of solar array wings and a single-engine nacelle emerging from a ventral mount. The wings hung limply, incorrectly deployed as the smaller craft had reverted out of warp speed. It drifted in a nose-down attitude relative to the Shenzhou's line of approach, and a tail of ejected coolant extended out behind it, ice crystals glittering in the dark. The second ship was a giant. Nearly a kilometer long, the forward quarter of the hull was a heavy ingot of metal dotted with a few illuminated viewports. A collar of pylons at the rear of this forward section sported four large warp nacelles, the intercoolers along the flanks of each one flickering with uncontrolled discharges. The rest of the huge vessel's mass was made up of a skeletal frame like the bones of a fish, upon which were mounted countless numbers of massive modular containers, all interlinked. It bore a vague likeness to the design of the old boomer-type warp freighters once in use all across the Federation, but the similarity ended there. Both of the craft had sculpted decorative fascia over their superstructures, an aesthetic layer suggesting the organic shapes of bulbous plants. Random patterns of green lightning crawled over the hulls of the alien vessels, the telltale signs of power cores bleeding off excess energy in the desperate attempt to forestall a critical overload. Any experienced spacer would only need to look at them to know that the life expectancy of the ships was running out. They slowed to impulse power, and Saru surveyed the scene through the clear sections on the deck of the bridge as Ensign Detmer brought the Shenzhou around. "Structure and configuration match known designs," he explained. "These vessels belong to the natives of Pilliar Zell." "No communications," Ensign Fan spoke up, anticipating the captain's next question. Her gaze fixed on the same view, Georgiou called out to the duty engineer. "Wheaton, that lightning effect on the hulls, is that what I think it is?"
"If you think it's sublimated warp plasma, then yes, Captain."
The ensign gave a grave nod. "I read identical fluctuation events in the warp cores of both ships," said Saru, studying his panel. "They're in a lot of trouble." His first instinct was to draw back, as if he were standing too close to a fire, and he ignored the urge.
"Are you sure?"
Commander Chithalo leaned over to see the readings for himself.
"There's a lot of interference on the sensors."
"Yes, sir," Saru allowed. "But the bleed from the warp cores is so strong, it's cutting right through it. That in itself is a very bad sign."
"How long do they have?" said Georgiou.
"Minutes at best," offered Wheaton.
"Send this in all known common protocols."
The captain took a breath.
"Attention, Pilliar vessels. This is the Federation starship Shenzhou. We stand ready to assist. Respond if you can."
Transmitting the message was standard operating procedure, but no one on the bridge expected to receive a reply.
"They won't answer,"
Burnham said quietly, her voice so low that only Saru heard her speak.
"They can't."
The inhabitants of the Pilliar Zell star system were citizens of an independent sovereign state that for many decades had eschewed interaction with off-worlders, preferring to maintain their own planets and a handful of regional colony holdings. But recently, their government had made overtures toward the United Federation of Planets, and they were exploring the possibility of UFP membership. As a xenoanthropologist by training, Burnham would have been the one to know more about the Pilliar culture than he, but Saru guessed that the most likely reason for the aliens reaching out to the Federation was the fear of ongoing Tholian expansion. With that thought preying on his mind, he eyed the long-range sensors warily, looking for anything out on the periphery that might have been a lurking spinner ship. Georgiou leaned forward in her chair as if she were pulling against restraints holding her in place.
"Any clue as to the origin of the Nadion pulse that crippled them?"
"The particle density is much higher around the bigger ship, the freighter," said Ensign Troke. "Best guess, the pulse originated inside the big one and knocked them both out of warp."
"I'd concur with that," said Wheaton.
"They were probably moving in close formation, the other ship acting as an escort."
"An engine malfunction, then?"
Chithalo considered the possibility.
"Not the result of an attack."
"We can worry about the cause after we deal with the effect," said the captain. "All right. If we can't communicate with them, what can we do? Is it possible to tractor them away from the denser areas of the particle field?"
"Tractors are operable."
At the op station, Ensign Troy Yanuzi unconsciously ran a hand over his bald scalp and glanced at the woman in the seat next to him.
"It's up to Kayla if she thinks we can drag them out."
Detmer's face soured.
"I'm not sure that's the best solution. The mass ratio isn't in our favor.
You're right, said Georgiou, thinking it through. That'll take too long, and we won't be able to use the transporters, not while the radiation still lingers.
Saru glanced at the display in front of Burnham, a live feed from the forward sensor array tuned to detect life signs. The readout fluctuated wildly. One moment it showed the ship's complement as fewer than a dozen, and in the next it was giving out numbers akin to the population of a large town.
I can't stabilize this, she said irritably.
The interference is too strong.
Anything from the smaller craft? He prompted.
She frowned.
A consistent negative life sign reading. I think it's an automated drone of some sort.
Captain! Troke called out in alarm, cutting through their conversation. The escort ship! Readings from its warp core are spiking. Captain, I think it's going to explode!
Shields to maximum!
Chithalo barked out the command, and all eyes turned toward the quadrant of the screen where the winged craft was adrift.
Georgiou raised her hand to cover her eyes just as the smaller Pelear ship blossomed into a tiny sun. The Shenzhou's bridge was briefly drenched in white and hard-edged shadows as a fatal collision of matter and antimatter engulfed the escort craft. A rolling, thundering tremor ran through the starship as the shockwave from the escort's destruction battered at the shields, and her ship reeled beneath the impact.
Status?
Georgiou's first officer reacted quickly, striding toward the damage control station.
Minor damage, no hull breaches, reported Wheaton.
But the Pelear escort?
It's vapor, sir.
The captain turned toward Troke's station and saw that the Tulian's normally healthy sky-blue skin tone had turned a sickly pale green. She knew what he was going to say next before he uttered the words.
The larger ship's warp core is exhibiting identical breach precursors. The same thing is going to happen to them unless they can stop it.
Why don't they eject the core and get the hell out of there?
Said Detmer through clenched teeth, almost as if she could send her demand through the void to the other vessel.
Won't matter, said Wheaton bleakly. They wouldn't be able to get far enough away to avoid the blast effect.
And even at full power, the Shenzhou won't be able to drag them out of the way.
That grim realization presented itself to Georgiou, and a heartbeat behind it came the prospect of a terrible choice. There were hundreds of lives aboard her ship, and she could save them all right now if she gave the order to warp out to a safe distance. She was in command, and her first responsibility was to her crew. But if they backed off, the runaway destabilization of the Pelear ship's warp core would certainly claim every life on that other vessel, and Philippa Georgiou would have to live with the knowledge that she let it happen. The captain drew herself up and began speaking, not so much for the sake of her officers, but once again for the record.
We have received no distress call. We are unable to interpret the intentions of the Pelear crew. Nevertheless, these are my orders. We are going to render all possible assistance to those people. If we wait for an invitation, it will be too late.
She glanced toward her first officer.
Commander, prep a shuttle for immediate takeoff.
Aye, Captain.
Chithalo set to work. Georgiou tapped a key on the arm of her chair.
Engineering, Commander Johar?
Here, Captain.
Get yourself a pilot, a medic, and a couple of your best technicians, then double-time it to the shuttle bay. You're about to take part in an unsolicited boarding action.
Right. I'll pack a Jolly Roger.
Johar paused.
Can I take Wheaton? He's good on the stick, and he knows his way around a hyperspanner.
He's on his way. Bridge out.
Georgiou threw the ensign a nod, and the junior officer stood up, masking a flash of anxiety as he did so.
Captain, I'd like to volunteer to join the rescue party.
Burnham stepped away from her panel, coming stiffly to attention.
They could use a science officer over there.
And it has to be you? The barbed comment fell from Saru's lips before the Kelpian was even aware he had voiced it. Burnham gave him a sharp look, and Georgiou saw the rekindling of the same argument she had interrupted in the mess hall. The two of them were both excellent at their jobs, but the ongoing issue of getting Saru and Burnham to work together had a habit of flaring up into conflict at inopportune times, and right now the captain had no time to waste. Michael Burnham was always the one to go into harm's way, and Saru was always ready with a reason to play it safe. Despite the grave seriousness of the situation, Georgiou suddenly saw a way to diffuse the tension between the science officers and hopefully solve the larger dilemma at hand. "A good suggestion, and your offer is appreciated, Lieutenant Burnham. But stand to and hold your station." The other woman couldn't mask her disappointment, but that turned to surprise when Georgiou glanced at the Kelpian. "Lieutenant Saru, join the team in the shuttle bay."
"Me?"
Saru's pale blue eyes blinked in shock.
"You," said the captain, nodding toward the turbolift. "Now snap to it."
The turbolift ran on priority pathing, speeding straight to the shuttle bay at the aft of the Shenzhou's primary hull without stopping, and Saru's thoughts were racing to keep up as he spilled out of the lift with Ensign Wheaton leading the way. What just happened? He had spoken without thinking, opening his mouth to criticize Burnham's eagerness to impress without stopping to consider the alternative, and now he was going to pay for it. Captain Georgiou had put him on the spot, and Saru had no choice but to obey orders and accept the assignment.
"I guess you weren't expecting that," said Wheaton as the two of them approached the shuttle Yang.
The ensign handed him a gear vest and an operations kit from a rack, then grabbed one of his own.
"Time to get your hands dirty, huh, Lieutenant?"
Saru couldn't be sure if he was reading sarcasm in the ensign's tone, so he ignored it. He clamped his mouth shut and silenced the misgivings that echoed in his thoughts as he shrugged on the vest. "Don't see this as a perilous situation," he told himself. "See it as an opportunity to show your mettle to the crew."
"Faster would be better,"
called the chief engineer, hanging out of the hatch at the back of the Yang's lozenge-shaped hull.
"Wheaton, get in here and get us moving while we still have someone to rescue."
The two of them scrambled aboard, and Saru found a seat across from Johar in the rear compartment as Wheaton vaulted into the pilot's chair and powered up the impulse engines. The hatch clanged shut, and Saru shot a look out of the forward canopy. The shuttle bay was already open, a glittering wall of force separating the atmosphere inside from the vacuum. Out beyond the Shenzhou, he could see the still-expanding cloud of radioactive debris that had been the Pilyar escort drone. The Yang lifted off, light blurring as the interior of its mothership fell away, and they rushed into space. Saru double-checked his gear as Johar launched into a brisk briefing.
"All right, everyone. We are on the clock here, so I need you all to work fast and smart. A Nadion pulse most likely means an overload in the secondary injector modules of the warp core, so we get in and we provide whatever help we can to stabilize it."
He pointed to the straw-pale female Vaksha seated next to Saru, a petty officer with the bronze tabs of an engineering specialist.
"Yashe, you know this stuff like the back of your hand, so I want you running point. Crewman Subin, do what she tells you. Understood?"
The thin Maserite woman across the cabin gave an emphatic nod in reply.
"What about me?"
Nurse Zoxum was dressed in medical division whites beneath his gear vest, and the husky Zano seemed eager to get started.
"There are going to be injured people over there. Count on that," Johar told him. "You're going to have your hands full."
Zoxum held up a heavy medical pack.
"I've got plenty of Hyronalin to go around. Speaking of which, time for a booster shot."
He loaded a hypospray with a vial of the anti-radiation drug and proceeded to work his way around the shuttle, injecting each person in turn.
"Lieutenant Saru," concluded Johar, "we only have a rough idea of what we're going to find over there, so I need your head on a swivel."
Saru touched his neck, wondering if the human literally meant what he said, then decided just to nod and not question it.
Aye, sir.
Approaching the target vessel, called Wheaton from the cockpit.
It's big, all right.
Johar moved forward and Saru followed, peering over the pilot's shoulder. Ahead of the Yang's prow, a wall of tan-colored